Welcome to Baltic Landlords, an international broadcast about real estate development, property management, and income sustainability. I am your host, David Sved, and my guest today is Auseklis Sarkans, real estate expert, co-founder, and partner at Starlux Investment for the past 9 years, and CEO of Doctorwell. As a real estate expert, Auseklis is also managing his own real estate investment and development masterclass. Auseklis, welcome to Baltic Landlords.
Welcome. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Let's start with real estate investments. As we know, there are two paths which investors can take to invest in real estate. One is called development and the other is the path of passive investor. I suggest we travel both of these routes to educate our listeners about how to recognize a good deal and what steps to consider. What is your take for investors who want to develop or renovate, let's say, a rental unit building in the center of Riga?
Well, of course, I mean, I think as already you said, I mean, you have to decide whether you're active or passive investor. I think that's the main thing. And not to confuse yourself, because if you really know that you want to be active, or in this case, we could call it like a developer, or not just developer, you know, sometimes active investor is just the one actually following their investments and following the objects and following the market. But nonetheless, so if you decide that you want to be active, then you have to sort of take into account that you have to like truly be in the market. You have to do the stuff. Sometimes that even requires to be almost full time or at least half time. So it will take quite a lot of time. It will take quite a lot of efforts because you have to follow the market. You have to understand it. You have to find the deals and then you have to actually execute on those deals on those projects. I mean, we can go step by step further if that's the idea here. You see, regarding renovations, actually, that's the segment we are mostly working with in our company. So we are actively developing, let's say, four apartment buildings at a time, mostly historical centers. So it's rather tricky. So since the podcast is for Baltic, so it might be a bit different in Tallinn or Vilnius, but at least in Riga, and the whole city center is UNESCO heritage. So it's actually of high importance from the cultural perspective, and hence any type of development, either new buildings or renovations or reconstructions, are somewhat tricky, are somewhat challenging. And in that segment, if you want to be a developer in that segment, I would say you really need a strong architect by your side to at least survive in that environment, because you can easily run into some obstacles that will prolong the project for a year or more than that. So that's, I think, the trickiest part with renovations. I mean, the other part, of course, is you never know. I mean, you have to assume that with renovations, you will buy a building and only when you start to work on it, to start to like actually do some construction works, only then you will truly see the whole picture of technical condition of the building. Yeah. Before that, you have to assume from basically visual inspection, you can do also construction inspection, but you never can truly get out of it because no one will let you, you know, to drill some holes in walls and in floors to actually get all the data you need. But that's just the risk part. If you are okay with that and if you are okay with a bit of uncertainty of what will be allowed regarding architecture, then it's doable. And we are doing it, and we are doing it quite successfully already for, I guess, 4 or 5 years. So, yeah, that's a business. That's a business opportunity.
And are there any cases where such investors who want to develop or renovate these properties hire all the staff that's needed to renovate?
Of course. I mean, of course, it depends on the investor. I mean, it depends on the situation. So, or how we are working actually with our investors is that, our investors are more or less passive. They have some active components, so meaning that especially our main investor, he still calls the shots. He still makes the last decision on every major topic. But we as a team do everything else, not just finding the property, getting the deal, getting a good deal, then putting it from all the aspects together, legal side, architecture side. We have several architecture companies that we are working with. then going through tenders, going through construction, renovation, and then marketing, sales. So it depends. I would say if you are a foreign investor coming to Riga and that's your like kind of first investment, then I would strongly suggest to get some local help, at least. Well, the scope of the help can vary, but at least someone who knows the market, who has done it. Of course, if you are local and you have already done one or two projects, then it's a bit different. I mean, I could perhaps even say if you're local and also doing the first project, the same applies. You need some professional to guide you through that. There are several in the market. We are one of them. Yeah, we are quite good ones. I would say we are one of the leading ones in many aspects. But just with renovation, we don't do new construction, at least at the moment.
Yeah, so theoretically, an investor who even wants to develop or renovate a property can remain in some way passive.
Yeah, sure. I mean, how actually, you already mentioned the lectures, I mean, how I teach the students is that I divide it that you can be active or passive investor, and then you can have active or passive investment. Mm. So investment is like a property or object, and then passive investment or passive property is that just generating cash flow, you're just not doing nothing with it, or just buying land and doing nothing it and waiting for the price to increase. And active, of course, is development or any sort of renovations, etc. And so an active and passive investor means just passive doesn't do almost anything, and then active does a lot. And then you have not just two kind of combinations, but then you actually have four combinations. And in our case, we mostly work with active investment properties as such, with quite a lot of development, quite a lot of risk, to be honest. But the investors depends. They are sometimes active, sometimes passive, sometimes in between, and so on. And that sort of structure works. And I would say that's actually the best way to look. So am I an active or passive investor? And then whether I want to be involved in active or passive investments as properties. Yeah, because you can be active investor and still invest only in passive properties. And that would be that you are just following the market, you know, buying when the price is low and selling when the price is high. That's the easiest sort of way. You're not doing almost anything with the property. You're just following the market. But to follow the market, you have to be extremely active investor, because that just takes a lot of time. That just takes a lot of efforts.
So in Starlux Investments, do you take the development side fully on your shoulders, or do you outsource some things to?
Of course, it's impossible to do it all. I mean, it's just huge amounts of work. And it depends on the project to project, and also depends on investor to investors. With some investors, we only do some parts. We only do perhaps research or strategy or pricing or marketing or sales or just general consultations. But with those where we actually get more involved, so how we do it, we kind of manage the project from A to Z. That part we do ourselves. We do all marketing and sales ourselves. We do all strategy, financing, that part ourselves. And then architects usually are outsourced companies. We are like working closely with several ones who already like long-term, let's say, collaboration experience. And the same goes regarding construction works. Regarding construction works, sometimes it depends. Sometimes we take just one like main company who actually does all the work and then gets subcontractors underneath them. Sometimes we skip that part and for smaller parts just take individual companies. It depends on the scope of the project. The larger the project, most likely we'll go with one big company, and the smaller the project or more like individual works, let's say renovate facade, renovate roof, maybe do some insulation, then that one perhaps you can do by combining smaller companies. And then of course just like, you know, as always, there's like a part of profit, and you can either give it to someone for managing that part of work or take it for yourself and do more work. Yeah, so it depends, but mostly we can, at least from management perspective, do it all A to Z. Yeah.
Okay, and what about the second route? What advice can you give to individuals who aim to achieve financial freedom by acquiring rental unit buildings with a sustainable income source already existing?
I mean, that's quite amazing. I would say opportunity for a lot of people. When you buy already finished building or even rented out, especially if it's in some decent quality. And it's not just for building, it could be also for apartment. I mean, we can just scale down all of these sort of conclusions. Just we work more with like buildings, but you can do the same with apartments. The main factor is that there is so much less risk involved. So it's just much more secure. I wouldn't even say much more, like really emphasizing that much more part. And for a regular person who is not a real estate professional, that in many cases that makes the most sense, because well, since you don't know the market, since you most likely don't know how to do all sorts of renovations and those things, all of those works will be highly risky to you, and you will most likely overpay for most of them. So you won't be able to compete in the market. You will always be somewhat left behind. But with rental properties, it's much easier. You don't have to know quite much about it. You just, I mean, even the price, I mean, it's not that hard to determine rental price. And it's not even that hard to rent it out. You can actually do that part yourself. If you want, you can of course manage that or give to some management, but you can do it yourself. So it's much easier, much less risk. Of course, the other part of the story is that it's usually less profitable, but nonetheless, I mean, it just depends on your preferences. A great way to do investments.
Okay, let's go deeper into this topic and talk about the financing stages for specifically rental apartment buildings. What are the options for investors who need additional funding or development or purchase of the house?
Well, the financing part, at least in Latvia or in Riga in this case, as mostly the financing will be applicable only, I guess, to Riga or Riga region, it's tricky. It's very, very tricky, to be honest. Well, if you have a good property and if you have already existing and proven track record of like revenues, from rent income, then of course it's easier. But still, the tricky part is that the maximum of years that the bank will agree for a loan, I think, is 10. Sometimes they're like saying, okay, we might do 15, but 10 is the maximum. Like at least how we feel that at the moment, what banks actually would like to have is actually 5 years. Well, the interest rate is not that high, but still, you can't go with very high loan to value, to be honest. You can do, I would say, maybe 40-50%. Well, 60 sounds quite a lot already, because if you will just divide those numbers, for example, you take 50% loan to value as a loan, for example, for purchase price, against the purchase price. Let's make things simple. So what happens is that, and you take it for 5 years, let's assume that each year you have to repay 10% of the value of the property just in the principal payment. And then on top of that will be some interest payment, let's say 1 to 2%, something like that, might add on top. And so you need like really profitable property to be able to afford it. So that's like no option there. Okay, you can go after those 10 years, which is sort of banks are okay-ish. And then you will see that you actually pay 5% of the value of the building each year. And then you put on top of that some interest rates, and it will turn to something like 6 to 7%. If you buy a ready-made property, and the yields will be also around 6 to 7%. So just not that much room there. So what has to happen, bank has to agree on 15 years of loan, and then you actually can take quite high LTV, let's say 50-60. Mm-hmm. If you cannot get that 15 years, and we know that there are some chances that you can get, we know that there are some banks who are doing it, but it's quite rare. Like 10 years is sort of like the standard, but again, also not that easy to get. Then you just have to live with that you will get 30%. Financing for 40 or somewhere there, and that's just the way it is, at least currently in Riga. And I would not say that it's like bad or good. It's just, you know, how I see with any sorts of investments, and especially with real estate. I mean, you as an individual player, you cannot change the market. So the market is there. You have like these are the rules for the game, for the investment game or development game. So either you play it or you don't play it. It's just don't try to change the rules. I mean, you can try to innovate, but nonetheless. But as for individual person, then there is a much easier. For an individual person, you can try to get like just a regular private person loan. And that one is quite good because that one you can get against your salary. And when you take that one, then no one kind of cares how high is the yield of the rental, let's say, apartment. The tricky part, at least in Riga and in Latvia, is that banks are not that willing to finance for a private person as a private loan. Bank is not willing to finance a residential apartment building. They're saying, okay, that's already commercial activity. You have to make a business account and take a business loan. And then this, like the things before applies. So those are the challenges in the market. But of course, you can always try to look for alternative financing. With alternative financing, well, rental properties with alternative financing are very tricky because if it's not that easy to afford a bank loan or it makes kind of things already challenging enough, then with private financing or alternative financing, usually rates are higher, so you can afford it even less. Sometimes how we structurize it, that you can do development part. So if you are buying a property and you have to renovate it before you're renting it out, so you can do those first steps with alternative financing or with some private financing, and then you refinance once you get the cash flow. Just you have to be very, very clear with the numbers that it has to make sense. In ideal case, you buy it for, let's say, 1 million, you put 1 million in renovation, and the value is 3 million. So then it only in those cases it will make sense. You can refinance from bank, and even so, bank will give you at maximum, let's say, 50% or something like that. You'll have decent enough money to repay the first loans if you get the idea. I think yeah. You get it. Yeah. So those are the strategies there and the ways to do it.
Which rental properties yield the best returns? Is it commercial or residential sector?
Well, of course, that's like. It depends a lot on a lot of things. If you look like from purely like data or statistics, then usually it is that the highest yields are for industrial buildings, currently for good, and this will be like for good properties, for great properties, let's say. Currently, it should be around 7 to 7.5% yield per year for those ones. Then the next sort of step below is usually depends on the market, but either retail or office. Currently, most likely office is retail. Maybe it might depend, but in Latvia's case, they are quite closely together. And they are something like 0.5% to 1% below those industrial ones. So we could say like 6.5% might be a good thing. And then usually below those comes residential, actually. But here we are speaking about like really good properties, like city center, let's say historical city center, completely renovated building, above average price, etc. So really good properties. Yeah. So with those, it will be lower, just on that scale to compare. Okay. On other scale, whenever you have a property which is in less good shape as like the best one or the great ones, the worse the property, the higher the yield should be. So if you want the highest yields, you should actually go after properties which are in like quite poor shape. If you can't still rent it out, we have an interesting case. One of our business partners in the company, his family owns a rental property, and they bought it in quite poor shape. They have like really high yield. I won't say, but it's definitely I won't say it.
Above the average.
It's definitely above. It's twice at least above the average. Yeah. And the tricky part is we did quite from time to time we do recalculations. And so the question he asks is, should I invest and actually finish the building? And it's very tricky. If you invest in it and finish it, you will have higher rental income, like euros per year, but you will have lower yield. As those additional investments cannot yield that high rental yield as he has for the purchase of the building. So he got just amazing deal, and the more money he puts in, the yield goes down. Of course, the risk goes down, as currently, if the building is in poor shape, your tenant is also, let's say, in poor shape. That's not the best tenant in the world. So you can improve the building, you can reduce the tenant risk, but also you have to live with lower yields. And then it just depends on person to person. Someone wants to get the maximum, then that's the choice. Someone wants sort of to get the minimum risk, and then someone gets in the middle, some kind of optimum. So that's that. But you also have to remember always that, especially with residential ones, especially in city center, that short-term rent is always much more profitable than long-term. And hence, those who did Airbnbs, they of course get much more. They of course get easily get 10, 12, even more than that if done properly. But those are always with higher risk. And as I said, the students, in some cases, you can never truly see that risk until something bad happens. Because while it's everything is good, you assume that the, like you kind of reduce the real meaning of the risk. You see that, oh, well, everything is fine. I'm earning money, and short term is always earning more than long term. So it's no brainer to go short term rent. But there are some risks associated with it, and of course those might not happen each year and every year. But they might happen in once in 5 years, once in 10 years. But when they do happen, you just have to be honest with yourself. You received higher yields before, so now the risk has happened. No, that's just how it is. I mean,
and it's definitely more effort to it.
Oh yeah, sure. But you can give it out to management, and still like if you like have a good property, it still should be so that long term rent is, let's say 7%. Just assume some kind of number here, and then short-term rent, let's say without management, when you're doing yourself, let's put like 12% or 11, and still it should be that even if you pay someone for the management and everything, you have to be better than with long-term rent. You have to still be better. It won't be that high a difference because the management company will take some piece of the profits, but nonetheless it should be higher. Just the risks are higher.
My previous guest told me a story about this one guy who became a millionaire in Latvia by buying up these poor and drawn down properties, wooden properties, and would just rent them out for this price, which is low, but the yield on the yield of return is much bigger than these.
Well, there's of course a question whether that's like available anymore in the market. But if you go like something like 5-10 years back, even 10 or even more, and of course there were quite a lot of those buildings, and you could easily buy them up, and yeah, the yields were great. I mean, for that person, the yield is also great. You know, it's
I heard it was somewhere between 10 to 15 or even sometimes high, more.
let's say for that person, it's about 15.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way. Quite a nice amount. 15, so it's a good number there.
Can you explain in simple terms for the listeners who are just getting their feet wet in real estate investing, what is market and financials modeling?
Interesting. Well, how I would look at it, so the market is usually like from purely simple terms, market is always about demand and supply. Like those are the two main factors which you have to look after. So demand is a bit, might be a bit easier to understand, as demand is just people willing to live, people willing to buy, people willing to rent or anything like that. Is the tricky part is that it's easier to understand it, but it's sometimes harder to actually measure because there is no clear data for it. I mean, sometimes you can use transaction data as to show how many people actually wanted to buy. And then you see how many deals are in the market. So that's the one number. And then supply. Supply is sometimes easier, sometimes trickier to understand. So for supply, it's fixed supply. If you look at secondary markets, so those buildings are already there. It's kind of fixed. But what is changing, it's how many of people are actually willing to sell their apartment. So there's like some change there. And then, of course, new properties that are being developed. So as for market, yeah, you check out those two. Whenever demand is bigger than supply, if demand is bigger than supply, it's called seller's market. So everyone who is selling is kind of in a strong position to negotiate, and hence can push either the price up or other deal, let's say, terms. And when it's vice versa, when your supply is larger than demand, then it's buyer's market. In buyer's market, usually the prices tend to go down, or you can get great deals, and the sellers are quite desperate, sort of, or not quite desperate, but it depends. But sellers have to fight with each other, have to, you know, compete on price, on terms to get a deal. Well, usually when the market is going up, when it's booming, then it's usually a seller's market, because the demand actually grows usually faster. Like, if the market is going up, if the economy is going up, wages are raising, so demand will raise much faster, usually tends to raise much faster than supply. And hence, it's going to seller's market, and the prices are increasing, etc., etc. And so when the market is going down, usually it turns to buyer's market. So in crisis, it's the best time to buy, as kind of, I hope you all know, also listeners. And then in the highest peak point of economic growth or any kind of growth is the worst time to buy. So that's for economic or market view. As for financial view, I mean, well, it's quite a complex topic, but if you want to like look at things in very simple terms, so I would suggest always measure profit as percentage per year. So that's kind of like my rule number one, which I try to sort of teach or also follow myself, as the profit per year in percentage terms. That's the main thing to look at. Sometimes people get like used to those square meter prices, either for rent or for purchase or for construction, and you cannot look at them individually. I mean, you could buy more expensive apartment if you can rent it out for more higher rent, and you can buy a cheaper apartment if you can rent it out cheaper. Yeah, so, and how you can compare more expensive with cheaper, you cannot compare the prices because the products are different. And then the only like kind of true measure is this percentage per year, and it doesn't matter whether if it's rental property, then it's rental revenues per year or yield. If it's for sale, then it's your profit per year, but per year. And well, yeah, so one or two. It's usually people use the term ROI for profit or for development, and then yield for rental.
So the strategies differ between the investor who is looking to flip his objects and, buildings, and between the ones who are looking for sustainable income source.
Of course. I mean, when you develop, well, the key things when you look for development, so you have to get like three to four. One is costs. You have to like have the bare minimum of cost. So you have to buy the property at an exceptionally good price. And of course, it depends. But if you want great profits, you have to buy it at a really good price. And you have to invest just the right amount. Just the right amount. Not too much, not too less, just the right amount. And like that amount should be, you should not overpay. So your investment should be like really effective. Then of course the other part is you have to sell at maximum price. It makes sense, yeah. And then the third thing for development is the speed. And speed sometimes is even more important than the first, those two parts. Sometimes let's take back the speed thing. You have the costs and you have then the revenues. You can calculate the profit. And if you would measure the profit as like euros, in euros term, just okay, my costs were 1 million, my revenues are 1.5 million, I have 500,000. So it's 50% profit or 500,000. So if you don't look at the time, so you could say, okay, this is a great investment. But then the time kicks in. And for example, if this project is for 2 years or for 5 years, so let's say 5 years. So 50% per 5 years, well, it's not that good anymore for development project. Yeah. If it's 2 years, well, it seems very interesting. If it's 1 year, it's great. I mean, it's amazing. And sometimes the people, when they're doing development, they disregard this time effect. They just look, okay, I have to go for minimum costs and maximum revenues, and I will sell the apartment, or I will keep selling it for like 2 years. But if you look from investment perspective with this profit per year as percentage as your main guidance, then you can easily see that that's like a really bad choice to do. So what you have to do, you have to reduce the price to sell it faster, much faster. If you can sell it like in 3 months for optimal price, most likely that's the goal there. So the speed, of course. Costs, revenues, but the speed for development. As for rental, it's a bit trickier. Is it trickier? I don't know. For rental, the speed actually is not that important. Because if you go long-term, you will still go long-term. So your speed is, if you buy the property and keep it forever, so your timing is not that important. It's like forever. But then for you, each euro here and there for costs and revenues actually makes a lot of difference. So for sale, you can make those discounts to get the timing faster. For rental, you really have to get your pricing right. For example, if you rent out an apartment, 500 and 510 is already a difference. It's already a noticeable difference. 500, 550 is a huge difference as for rental income. Yeah. And the same goes for costs, actually. Like either you pay 10 euros or your tenant pays 10 euros, for example. It's a huge difference already. If you multiply by 100 apartments, it's a huge number as well. Or at least significant number. So that's the game for rental as you compare it to development.
What are the two or three most common mistakes that investors make in these real estate purchases or transactions based on your practical experience?
Usually, I would say that the first one is, but that's just not for real estate. I think that's for everything. I mean, stick to what you know, do what you know, or do what you can do like really good. So if you don't know how to do real estate or investment or development, then just don't do it. At least don't do it on active level. Then be just like a passive investor, invest money or give money to someone who actually knows what he's doing and then do it together. Or if you don't know but you still want to do it, then just accept that the first project most likely will be your learning and it won't be the most profitable. So just don't expect that it will be super profitable, the first one. So we expect that the first one will be, if it's break even or a small profit, it's great because you have a lot of learning pains. So that's, I think, thing number one. Thing number two, as I said, for development is definitely speed, which is of very high importance. And then the third one, if we go, like, we can go for rents, usually people don't take too much these small costs or small revenues into consideration. So how I would put it that it makes a lot of difference whether, as I said, something is paid by you or by the tenant. Tax or some maintenance fees or some communal payments or some insurance payments and those things, as they add up, and you have to count like okay, this is my rental price and then this is everything on top of that, and you have to take all of it into consideration. And sometimes people just do, okay, I will have rental price, so let's say 500 euros, but it will include most of the stuff, and then the tenant will only pay communal payments. So then in those cases your rental price is not 500 euros, it's let's say 450 or 400, as you actually have quite a lot of cost in it. Yeah.
Okay, and I really want to hear your opinion on this one. Is there a district in Riga with underestimated potential in housing stock right now?
Of course there is. A lot of them. I can show you the one of them. So you can ask me for more in private, because if I say all of them, then the hell will sort of disappear. Yeah. That's with a little of joke there. Well, there are several, of course. The general rule of thumb is you have to look close to city center, and then you have to look for area which is not yet that developed. So those are like your two ingredients to find it. If you look at Riga, it's not that hard to identify those. We have in the further end of city center, basically the whole circle, like the sort of end circle or around city center, that's definitely this Moskva's Vorstadt, or like that part near the railway station. definitely is one of those. And then the same goes on the opposite side of River Daugava. Disregard the closest part of Agen's Constituent Consent but take like the third line, let's say, from Daugava. And then you'll start to find a location which is most likely good. Outside of that, most likely you can also find, but I think that the main thing will remain how close it is to city center. I mean, that will still remain as your one of your biggest guidelines there.
How do you think these Riga city plans for 2030, which is to basically move the center to the other side of Daugava River, will impact the Riga infrastructure as a whole?
I think you cannot move the city center that easily. So the city center will, or the business will create city center more than the government or officials. In Riga, of course, it's a bit tricky because if you look from office buildings, then we don't have like one specific area in Riga which could be called this central business district. I mean, in many cities you have like one specific area, and Riga is quite in many locations, and few of them are on the one side of River Daugava and few are on the other side. If you would ask me, I would say that part which is sort of the next city center on the left side of River Daugava in Pardaugava, of course it has like quite high development potential and quite high, I would say, appeal to investors, and they are actually putting the money in it and developing those areas. So in that case, yeah, that will be, but I would not say that and hence the other part will suffer. I would not think so. I think it will remain that in Riga you don't have one specific area for city center. It's like sort of dispersed in several locations, and it will just remain as it is. And I think you just have to deal with that, and you just have to see that. And I think there was this Riga X strategy or something like that, like an interesting document. And they identified that we will have like kind of clusters, and one cluster will be like in VEF or in Teika. And then one will be in the Smukstal seal or touring counts, and then one will be around Ballasta Dambis, and then one will be in Skanste, and then I think one will be in city center. So some kind of five or six, and I think the one also is creating near airport or near Spitze, like this on the Ulmaniegatan there. So those are just your clusters, and just have to live with that, I guess.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about these business center clusters here in Riga, because in other cities like Luxembourg, for example, is I think a great example of the city where they have segmented these parts of town where it's only office buildings, and then in the old town of Luxembourg it's only bank buildings and such parts.
Yeah, Luxembourg is a bit smaller city, so that for them that might be a bit different reasons. But usually you have this central business district, and it goes hand in hand with prime office or prime retail properties, and that's why it's good, because sort of the best buildings tend to be together, or the best tenants tend to be together, and they make like some kind of this cluster of very high density buildings in that area. So actually there are research that sort of states that it's good to have those high rise buildings as economic output. One of the factors influencing economic output is that how many people are working in as close area as possible, as it makes just easier to collaborate, to close deals, to make some ideas. So it's sort of it's also in that sense a good. We'll see. I have my bets on this Ballasta Dambis area. That's my okay. I have like my card there.
Okay. I know that in the beginning of your real estate career, you also have had an experience in property management. On what lessons can you reflect from that experience?
Well, that was quite an interesting experience. We were helping to manage a property. It's in historical city center, quite large. I mean, not super large, but quite large. I think it was 6,000 square meters, something like that. It had both it had retail and offices and apartments.
So mixed space.
Yep. And well, our task was we tried to systemize everything. We tried to create systems for everything. So, but it was like a long time ago, it's already 10 years ago. So at that time, well, at least for them, it was not that common. They, for example, had some kind of automated way to write those invoices to each tenant. So it was just a bit messy, some parts on paper, some parts on Excel. So we automated all of that. So I think if you want to do professional, like if you want to be an investor in those buildings or you want to be a manager of those buildings, they have to work like quite efficiently. I mean, you cannot waste a lot of time on those things. You cannot sit for, I don't know, 3 days and write invoices. That's just a waste of time. You have to, I don't know. Of course, nowadays we have systems, etc. So you can click a button and it just happens. Then we built it on in Excel. But the same thing, that once a month you just put in all the measurements for this common space, communal payments, because there was very tricky with those communal payments. It was like not only a part of those apartments and had like individual counters, so
most of them were fixed.
Yeah. And so we had like specific formulas how it just changes and calculates. So that was interesting. Then of course changing those tenants, improving tenants, it's also a big part. As especially if you have some tenants for a longer time, well, the good thing is that that reduces your risk that the property is not empty. But sometimes it's quite hard to raise the rental price if the person is already for 5 years in the property. So he just keeps on going. So the learning there, of course, is always you have to put some kind of indexation of rental price in the agreement so that you don't have to worry about it each year. As otherwise, 2 or 3 years passes and you really want to raise that rent. And then the hard talk. We were young, we did not do the hard talk. That was the main property manager, who was also a co-owner of the building. He did the hard talks. He went and sort of tried to renegotiate. And sometimes it was successful and sometimes not. So I think it's much easier to just put it in the agreement. And then just it goes by that. So I think those might be the two ones. And then we helped to attract the financing and helped also to do parts of the remodeling, but then they kept on going and I moved, transitioned to more wider set of services.
What are the differences between residential and commercial real estate management in your view?
Well, for residential, it's always you have to, usually tends to be that the residential one, you have a lot of tenants and they are all individual people, and it just sometimes takes more work on the relationship, more work on communication, more work on informing, more work in those regards. With commercial property, especially big ones, sometimes you have only 1 to 2 to 3 tenants. So that communication part or writing out of invoices is not there. There it's much more about the technical part of it. So everything has to work from technical perspective, especially if those are, I think most of the modern buildings already have, they have quite complex systems for, I don't know, ventilation, heating. So you have to be very effective how you actually manage those. I think for commercial, it's more about technical side, I would say. And then for residential, I would say it's more about like the management of tenants themselves. That's how I would put it together. Of course, the indexation applies to both and those things. But and of course, also you have to take into consideration that for commercial property, if you lose a tenant, it's usually much more painful. Since you have not that much tenants, each of them compose quite high percentage of your overall, let's say, property structure. With the residential, it's just the tenants, it's not that heavy on you. Of course, you have to be very efficient. What's the timing? So you have to be able to rent out your apartment within 1 month. That's, I think, maximum. That's just maximum. 2 weeks, I think, is ideal. And with commercial, of course, that does not apply. Yeah, so those, I think, might be my views, at least.
Yeah, in commercial, that doesn't work because these premises that you own, they are not that, yep, they yep. don't have that big of a auditory.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. I mean that and if you recall, you asked about those yields of commercial and residential, and it sometimes you could say it goes back to that one. You see, it is true that for residential apartment building, you have a lot of potential customers, like a lot. And hence, you could say that, especially for smaller ones and like economic level, and you could say that you have like very high liquidity. If you would like, and if some tenant is like, making some large argument out of something, sort of you have to fire him or you have to let him go. In this case, you could say you can easily, like 1 month at maximum, 2 weeks, you get a new tenant. In commercial property, it's not so easy. Sometimes if the tenant will leave, and the tenant knows that if he will leave, you will, for example, you will have a year of empty space, which actually won't be for zero. It will be negative. It will be as a loss because you have a lot of costs. And hence there, since it's much less or much fewer people are actually in the market for those properties, it's more illiquid and it's more risky. And anything that's more risky has to have higher returns. It just has to have. Otherwise, no one would invest in it. So if for the same investor, he looks at two properties from all the aspects which are the same, and one is apartment building and one is office building, then the person should invest in the apartment building for lower return. Or in other ways, paying higher, let's say, square meter price than for the office building, as the risk is lower. And I think the COVID just proved this even more, that retail, hotels, offices just have higher risks than residential. Because people still have to live in any situation, I would say. It's hard to imagine a situation where people won't be renting or won't be living. I mean, in huge economic downturn, of course. You just cannot afford to pay for your apartment. But other than that, no.
It seems obvious to me that in these commercial building cases, if the client is bigger, the riskier it gets, right?
Yes, I mean, at least the turnover is risky. But it's not always that bad because sometimes those big tenants also have long-term agreements which you cannot break. So sometimes we also have had experience with properties where you only have one tenant for the whole building. But the tenant has an agreement for 10 years and it cannot be broken from the tenant side. He has to pay the full amount each of those 10 years, even if he is not using the property. So, like, very strong agreement. And the company is very large. So they cannot sort of say, oh, we don't have money. That's not from reputation view and also not from financial or from legal view. So, if you don't have those agreements, then of course, yes. If you have those agreements, then not. But still, if you even have those agreements, it's not easy to get a new client or a new like tenant with such huge, such long rental agreement or with like such specific terms there. It's hard.
So for example, if Mikrotik was decided to, for some reason, tomorrow leave the premises and get new ones, they would still be obligated to pay the current.
I'm not sure about them, but I don't know about them, where it's more common, it's in those properties which have specifically been built for some tenant. As an example, a shopping center, Rimi. Let's say Rimi. Rimi owns part of their stores and then is a tenant in other part of the stores. And where they are tenants, they actually have 5 to 10 years of agreement. And sometimes the developer says, okay, I will build you this store just for you, and I will build it exactly as you like. But what you have to give me in return, you have to be tenant in that property for, let's say, 10 years, and you cannot break it. And it's like kind of win-win, because Rimi does not have to invest in that building. They don't have to do all of those risky development stuff, because they are like a store. They are in different business than real estate development. And the developer knows that, okay, if I will build it, it will be full. Because the biggest risk is to build like a retail space and no one wants it then. It's just like, no, I think no one in their like sound mind, no one is doing that, to be honest. I think most of those retail, at least the smaller shopping centers, are being built when you know who is the tenant.
Where are we in real estate cycle? I know this is one of those two questions that you have had hard time answering before, but has anything changed in this regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had some kind of discussions where I said that I can answer almost any question, but this is the one which is, it's the hardest one in some way, but it's also the most uncertain one. Like, I think the fair answer is no one knows, of course. If you look from statistics, from data, and from forecasts about economic growth, it would kind of tell you that the lowest point is already in the past. So that would be the thing from the data, and the markets are starting to rise. However, it's very tricky to say, as it's very hard to predict whether another economic shift will happen in the coming years or in the coming month. I guess in this case, even if it does, then it could be that we might have another, let's say, down period. But if not, then the market should be rising again. And that's at least from that perspective. I still do know and give some credit to those people who are raising alarms that, hey, a lot of money has been borrowed, a lot of money has been printed on the government level in this case, that it's not sustainable. And that is the thing that I think no one knows, and you can only sort of choose what you believe. Either you believe that the government will hold out and it will be sort of for government business as usual. Yeah, we printed out a lot of money. Yeah, we took a lot of loans, but still it's just the way we manage our country and finance and do stuff. Or you believe that it will sort of break in some point. And I would say no one knows that. And that's like highly uncertain. You just have to choose your position. As with real estate, no matter which position you will choose, you won't be able to act so fast with it. Like, real estate is not that liquid to make quick deals. It's not like, I don't know, crypto. Yeah, you know, you can sell or buy instantly. Mm-hmm. It's not like that. So you have to choose like what you believe in somewhat medium term, and then you have to stick to that more or less. You can be wrong, or the market could show that it's otherwise. But at this point, I think you cannot blame yourself, because that's highly uncertain. So to wrap it up, yeah, I would say, I mean, I'm quite optimistic in many ways. So I would say that if the governments hold, and if the finances hold, and if economic growth is just continuing to go up, and if we don't have the second or like major economic downturn, then the sort of the down period is already behind us.
Tell me more about your real estate investment and development course. Oh. What is your goal with this masterclass?
Hi. Well, it's quite interesting. I started to do it, I think already now 2.5 years ago. Well, the goal, of course, is to, well, in some way, I'm in a service business. I'm like, you could call me a consultant or an expert. And when you are that, you can, like, my work with clients involves my time, and it's hard to scale the time, like in a good way. And one of the ways how you can scale it is that you put part of it in some kind of digital content, or not just digital, also you can do it in person, but somehow like that. You put like your knowledge, your expertise in that, and you can sort of scale it to more people, so I can help more people. And at the same time, I can reduce the cost of it, because of course, to do individual consultations for projects, it costs just more. And so, and I see that it just fills the gap, because in the market, there will be those who wants to have individual consultations and those things, and I still have those, and it's not so that they are reducing or something. Yeah. And then always in the market, there are those who want to do it for themselves, who want to learn from themselves, etc. So for them, it's aimed the masterclass. So in those terms, yeah, it's for real estate owners, developers, and investors who wants to invest and develop real estate, and in this more effective way, and as I said, in more like rational way. It's a lot about numbers, a lot about analysis, a lot about strategy, a lot about Excel. So it's about actually calculating that success and that development, not just, you know, imagining or just, you know, going just with your gut feeling. So it's all about calculations and data and analytics. What's interesting actually is that I'm teaching at university, and I'm teaching in Latvian and English. And so this year I will also have a course in English available. Masterclass, it will be in English.
In Riga Technical University, right?
Oh, it's in Riga Technical University. It's already for some time. I think I have already three groups there.
Yeah.
But I will have a private course in English for those, actually, for the Baltic developers who wants to develop real estate in Riga. How to get what Riga is all about, or what Riga region is all about, where to get the data, where to get all the information, how to calculate, etc., etc. So actually, you can apply for that already in the website. And of course, the regular one in Latvian, just for local people.
And yeah. The full course is 12 weeks, right?
Yep. It's still 12 weeks of quite intense learning, to be honest. It's intense 12 weeks, to be quite fair.
That means every day there are lessons?
No, it's not that hard, of course. No. It's most of it is in video lecture format, and then we meet once a week for Q&A. The Q&A is something like 2 to 2.5 hours, and then the video content is around 6 hours, 5. It depends on the week. So in total, I like to say it's like an hour a day. So it's a decent commitment, but it's doable if you are like really interested in that one. And for me, I always say that that course is for those who like really serious about it. It's not like for beginners. I have smaller course for beginners, but the masterclass, like for those who I know I want to develop it. And if you really do know that, then of course you will find ways to find the time and energy and resource to do it. So it's for those who are quite serious about it.
My colleague has finished your masterclass, so I can only approve to the listeners that there's only good feedback from this masterclass.
Yes.
Where can people find you?
Well, they can find me in the market. I'm the one buying the properties you wish you could buy. No, that's a bit a joke. But of course, in the market, in social media, I'm quite, not quite, but somewhat active in LinkedIn and on Facebook. I'm also have an account on Instagram. Regarding the services, those are in the website. I hope you will put the link for the website, but for the audio, it's like invest.starlex.lv. So invest.starlex.lv, that's the website, which has all of our services and all of our trainings. Like all the information there is for those. And yeah, and you can call me or you can write me. And I think you'll put in my email at least.
Of course.
So that's that. And usually the first talk with me is without any compensation, so we can just, you know, have a chat or have a call, and then just see where it goes.
Okay, I appreciate this conversation, Osip. Thank you for sharing your time with me and Baltic Landlords, and thank you everyone who is listening. Thank you
very much. Thank you.